You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
9 minutes after 11, welcome to the third and final hour of the show. Today of breaking news at 11:30, slight change in schedule that is necessitated by the news cycle. That's the joys of live radio. We're going to be talking to Karima Brown about the cabinet reshuffle that had just been announced. Who's in, who's out, and what does it mean? Make sure that you are closely glued to your wireless. Well, you'd have to be close if you're glued, right? So make sure you're glued to your wireless. In fact, for the whole hour, because right now we're going to be talking about the history, or in some ways really industrial sociology, I reckon, but the history behind the modern concept of sleep. Absolutely fascinating. I wonder how many of you have thought about our sleep habits and whether they come from Mother Nature or whether they come from the capitalist pigs, or perhaps a combination of the two. Joining me in studio from the University of Cape Town in our Cape Talk studio is the academic head of the Department of Historical Studies at UCT, Dr. Bodhisattva Kaur. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I had sleepless nights about saying your name. Did I mangle it or did I get it right?
You got it quite right. Thanks.
Now, I saw an article that was based in part on your work, and I thought, my goodness, we simply have to get you on the show. And what is fascinating is many of us do not think twice about where sleep fits into our life. We see it as a little coma we go into before we get up and go. But there are important histories that are revealed by sleep, right? And why are they important?
Absolutely, Eusebius. If you miss out on the histories of sleep, you are, in effect, missing out on the one-third of all human history. Look at it this way. So it's very, very interesting to think about sleep precisely because we generally do not think about it. We take it as granted, as a given, as such a natural phenomena that we never imagine that sleep actually has always been and continues to be a major and fundamental site of social contestations, negotiations. And if we look at the histories of sleep, we can think about all the issues that underlie it. Think about issues of privacy, for example. Issues of what time it is good to sleep.
Yes.
Think about the sleeping arrangement. Think about how sleep has become a function instead of an experience in modern society, how it is related to work, how the continuous medicalization of sleep, the accessorization of sleep, it's quite mind-boggling that what the histories of sleep can reveal.
You know, it's so interesting because I hadn't given any thought to how even our language reveals the social meanings that are imbued with sleep until I read about some of your work, Dr. Kaur. And let's go through some of them because some of them are obviously recognizable and people will have, aha, that's so true, moments when we talk about it. We talk about, for example, the creative genius that is the insomniac, the early riser. I mean, there is one of your colleagues at UCT who loves her whole social media gang that she has started in terms of rising at 3 a.m. to begin work on your PhD. And it's almost like a virtue to be up early. And then if you are having a little bit of a slumber in Parliament, we see you as inherently unproductive. And if I get the insight right, and I want you to unravel it for me, you are suggesting that the language that we use to describe some of this behavior is not innocent. They carry with them histories and social signifying.
Absolutely. I always tend to think about it in these terms when you bring up the question of language, that why markets never sleep and workers are always sleepy.
Yes.
Right? I mean, we have all been chided that why do you fall asleep? So falling asleep has always been associated in our language with some kind of, you know, sloth, some kind of lethargy, indolence, laziness and inattention. The interesting thing is that, on the other hand, we always glorify, for example, in kind of insomniac rationality. We glorify people who never sleep, right? So it's quite interesting to think about these issues, that when such languages actually begin to take hold of.
You've given South African MPs a wonderful out, because these things are culturally specific. They haven't just changed across time in specific locales. They also differ from one region of the world to another. And in Japan, they have this wonderful, wonderful term that will challenge Dr. Ntlozi, who's been accusing ANC MPs of being sleepers. And there is a notion of what being present while being asleep.
Yes, and I understand that in Japan they already have been having this debate for a long time over the attentiveness and alertness of parliamentarians in particular. You know, on the other hand, it also must be said that the kind of language that we use now is also kind of underwritten by a whole set of structures of life. So just to use the language of resistance, I'm falling asleep and therefore I'm just, you know, being decolonial to some extent, that will be actually lazy, in my opinion.
Yes.
Because the thing is that have we really thought about how other activities of our life are arranged around sleeping?
Well, that brings me to the next thing. I'm going to jump around with the themes, because this is where the politics of sleep matter. And anyone who was wondering, Eusebius, what are you talking about? This is not Eusebius Mackay's show stuff. Well, it is, isn't it, Dr. Carr? Because the major shifts in sleep patterns coincide with industrial capitalism, the same way in which you cannot talk about the history of football in the UK without looking at the coincidence between working class communities, the pacifying effect of football, and industrial capital. And it turns out that sleep deserves a chapter in that history as well.
Absolutely. You are right on the money. The thing is that, you know, historians have shown now quite conclusively that for much of human history, humans, like many other animals in the natural world, had always had kind of what they technically called polyphasic sleep, which is you sleep in phases, in different segments. You sleep for a few hours, then you wake up, and then you sleep again. And even in Europe, the homeland of industrial modernity, until the 17th century, there are ample evidences that that was their most common pattern of sleep. The interesting thing is that people would actually wake up, do a little bit of work in the night, and then again kind of, you know, discuss, have a conversation, and then sleep again. Now, the interesting thing is that this major shift happened with the onslaught of industrial factory-based production, where the machines demanded that we work for compacted 8 hours, right, at a go.
Yes.
And the interesting thing is that if you look at the early records of the first industrial revolution, there are horrible records of accidents, and workers are always being complained of that they are sleeping, right? That it is there. It was always said that they are so so inattentive, they are so lethargic, that that's why they get into accidents. The thing we know now quite for sure is that their sleep patterns were disrupted fundamentally, because now people were asked to be attentive for long, 10, 12 hours, because that was the kind of the stretch of the workday in during the first industrial revolution. And then they were asked to sleep for compacted 6, 7 hours. So, you know, in a way, the nature of task orientation, the demand for greater synchronization of labor, that basically forced a new sleeping pattern on the majority of the working class.
That is so,
and that's a history we have come to forget. Because the other thing, if I can just say another thing about industrial capitalism, is that this is also the time, think of it this way, that when particularly, you know, there's so much investment in bed, you know, textiles because of colonialism, textiles become available, pillows become much more available, much more common because they're now affordable, curtains, there's candle, there are all kind of rituals about sleep and all the rituals about reading a book before sleep, having a glass of milk before sleep, you know, sleep is being privatized for one social class. While on the other hand, the working classes, the poor, the urban poor, the migrants to the city, they are being forced to sleep in public places, right? Mm. This is also the time when rough sleeping happens. And this is a problem that we see in South Africa even today,
Absolutely.
Right? We have 200,000 homeless people in this country, 7,000 sleepers under the bridge and street corners in this city only. And that has to, that never enters our imagination
Absolutely.
When we are thinking from our middle class vantage point about sleep.
Let's take a break there. This, I have to confess, has been one of the most fascinating 15 minutes of radio I've ever heard. The history of sleep. Have you ever thought about it? I know that some of you who think you are very woke on the left, you can use phrases easily around the dinner table about such things as the military-industrial complex of the US. Well, tonight you can go and show off and talk about the sleep-industrial complex, 20 minutes after 11.
702 and Cape Talk.
24 minutes after 11, if you've just joined us, you are listening to The History of Sleep and how modern sleep patterns and the concept of sleep actually has got multiple histories and social meanings. And unsurprisingly, it bears interesting relationships with industrial capitalism in particular. And we're in conversation with an expert on the histories of the everyday in Dr. Carr, the head academic department of historical studies at the University of Cape Town. Dr. Carr, before industrial capitalism resulted in these major shifts in our sleeping patterns, what were the patterns? Did we sleep typically twice in the 24-hour cycle?
Yes, there are kind of variations, at least twice, I would say. But in certain other parts, there are also evidences of three or four segments of sleep. The interesting thing is that all those had to be somehow monitored, disciplined, and regularized according to the need of the factory-based capitalism.
You know what's interesting is that when people worry about not getting enough sleep, not being able to fall asleep at night, you have your sleeping medication that you take, mm-hmm. and you've now unpacked an entire industry. What is the connection between biology and history? And what I mean by that more precisely is that we've often thought that sleep is a biological necessity. And if you have trouble falling asleep, that the person to speak to is not Dr. Carr about how you've been shortchanged by the history of capitalism, but your pharmacist to give you something to knock you out at 10 o'clock.
Absolutely. But how did that come about? That's what I'll ask, right? So the question is, you're very right, because this is the interesting discovery where people realized that, well, yes, it is a biological necessity. Everyone falls asleep, at least almost everyone. And at the same time, very early on in human history, people in different parts of the world have also developed different mechanisms of fighting sleep for performing certain kind of tasks. The interesting thing is that most kind of, you know, prominent and most well-documented examples of this can be found in the late medieval period, where, for example, in monasteries, the monks start kind of, you know, night vigils, and they often have a fear of the night as the time of temptation, the time of committing, when humans are prone to committing sin. And that is when they develop all sorts of rituals and sleep fighting techniques. The interesting thing is that those techniques become generalized only in the course of the 18th and 19th century across the world as industrially fueled colonialism began to reorder the world according to its own kind of need. Mm. And that is when, a lot of changes actually made this possible. I can talk about, for example, the history of infrastructure. You can think about like how the coming of the street light in the end of 17th century in Europe, and then by the 19th century spread to other parts, and then generalized over the 20th century, how the coming of the of street light, how the architectural development of a notion of separate bedroom, how the practices of separating children from co-sleeping with mothers, and obviously the trade in caffeine, the enormous sugar rush produced by the slave worked plantations, all these have major, major impacts. But nothing, you are right, Eusebius, nothing changed this landscape more dramatically than the chemically produced sleeping pills. And that, again, is on a mass scale, this is a phenomena that we are dealing with on such an enormity of scale, only from the end of the Second World War.
Final questions I want to put to you for now, but I'd love to have you back on the show, particularly about other aspects of the history of the everyday. But I wanted to ask you, it's weird because capitalism creates these artificial demands then to try and sustain itself. Mm-hmm. Artificial light, what impact that has had on keeping us awake now that it's not dark when it should be dark in the house. And at the same time, we're now expected to work late because we have electricity and your boss wants you to be available after dark for meetings, even dinner meetings and what have you.
Absolutely.
And then at the same time, you're supposed to be as fresh as a daisy at 6 a.m. for which you have to take a pill. So there's an entire value chain around the commodifying of sleep.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The more sleep deprived we are, the more, the more investment is being made in chemical alternatives and solutions of neurological and physiological problems.
Final question. Is it possible for us to fight back to our natural rhythms, or have we been so gridlocked by the history of industrial capitalism that we can only but look in horror at what it has done to the way in which we live now?
We just need to realize, I would say, that it takes courage to take a nap.
I'm going to take an afternoon one and I will not feel guilty. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Carr, the head academic, Department of Historical Studies at UCT. And what absolutely, isn't it fascinating what histories one can dip into and how it all comes back to politics and industry.